Hey, Smutters.
Hey, Smutters.
How's it been going?
Sorry. I'm scrolling through Instagram and here's another Britney video.
I can't with that.
Like, she's always in the same spot in her house. Does she not have anybody that lives with her? Like,
yeah.
There's so many questions I have about all these dances that she's doing and stuff.
They're all the same. And
you know what that just reminded me of?
What?
When Ashlyn was little and she was, Can you do this?
Well, like I told you last night, it's Britney Spears. She doesn't need that attention, you know? Like, every, well...
She used to be so precious, like, yeah, when she was younger.
Like, Britney could do no wrong when she was young. Even when she, like, shaved her head and all that, I was always...
I'm on your bandwagon now about... It's a different Britney.
Yeah, that's not her.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, everything's going good. And Smutters, we are having a special edition episode tonight because, actually, it's not tonight. We are recording this right now at 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Like, insomnia has hit me really hard the past week. Mm-hmm. I've been sick or whatever. And so, I'm sitting here and I'm bored and I'm trying to think of ways that I can aggravate Jen, and me sticking my finger in her mouth while she's sleeping wasn't working or anything like that. So, finally, I pushed her and woke her up. I was like, hey, let's just record. And she woke right up.
Well, when you say let's record, I'm all for it because usually we're watching something, I'm like, want to record, and you're like, let's just wait a little while and then we will.
Well, I did cocaine about it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying
to... And also, thanks for the Halloween, the Valentine's Day candy you brought in. That's probably why I can't sleep. I have so much sugar coursing through my veins right now that it's probably keeping me wired.
Not to mention the Reese's Valentine's hearts look like ball sacks. So they...
Yeah, be warned, guys.
They could have made that, like, they're terrible hearts to start with. But then, like, who makes a heart like that?
Yeah.
Reese's. They knew what they were doing. Naughty. But,
Speaking of naughty, I just read an interesting article.
What?
There is a dark, naughty part of Build-A-Bear after hours.
Yeah.
You knew that already?
I knew that.
Oh, well, hell, okay. No,
I mean, they don't, like, when I heard about it, I was like, oh, what's this? You know, is it, how crazy is it? And it's not super crazy. It's just, like, stuff that you, the kids shouldn't have. It's not like they're doing it or anything like that. It's just, yeah. But anyway, my week has been okay. And tonight we are doing our very special Valentine's Day episode, I guess.
Are we doing my about my movie?
Huh?
Remember my movie?
What movie?
I made you watch it a long time ago. My Bloody Valentine.
And
then they remade it.
Yeah, we need to watch that because you love that movie. And but no, we're not doing that. And we had so many ideas, and I had this one on my mind, and then you were like, well, what about this and this and this? So we may do two Valentine's Day episodes because it's in the middle of the week, so next week may be another one.
We could do Cupid.
I know, because I was like, when you said that.
All right.
No. Oh. He's a, because I started looking stuff up about Cupid, and I think he's like,
You know what I think about a lot when we talk about Cupid?
Mythology type person. A god. Not a god, but you know. What?
Cartman's Cupid.
Cupid me. No Cupid me.
No.
That is so dirty.
South Park, though. You gotta love it.
I love South Park. I was trying to think if we had heard anything. You watched a lot of crazy stuff last night.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just... Literally, I don't know. I think I'm numb to a lot of stuff now because there's so much shit constantly happening now. And I know the old saying, you know, you get older, time starts speeding up and, you know, whatever. But the thing is, like, there's literally something new every day going on, whether it's in the political arena, the, you know,
the supernatural.
Yeah. I mean, just everything. There's something new. And I watch a new video almost every day of the of a glitch in the Matrix. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just, it's crazy. And yeah. Once you go down that rabbit hole, it's hard to get out.
Well, I thought, like, I know Instagram and stuff kind of, like, suits to how you are or whatever with the videos.
Yeah, I did that with TikTok for me, too. So, now when I watch, I'm not a big TikTok fan, but now every time I get on it, it's stuff about glitches in Matrix and aliens and...
Yeah, like... I see tons of stuff, and I, like, in my head, I'm like, is everybody seeing this? Like, is this what everybody sees?
Why is nobody talking about it?
Yeah, like, why does nobody talk about it? And then it hit me. I was like, oh, this is, like, formed for me. It's not, it's, like,
but still, my though, interest. Stuff that you would think people, if they saw, they'd be like, what the hell?
No, because, like, I'll talk to my mom, and I'll say something about it, and she's like, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, and look at it, too. The people... The government come out and said there's aliens, and we just like, okay, what's next?
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know. It's so crazy. And I had another story prepared that goes into all this. It's a big conspiracy theory thing. And I'm so excited to do that story because I'm
turning the volume down, but I'm doing this as an example.
Oh.
Well, that's a scary job in the North Sea.
Oh my gosh, have you seen that video? And this is kind of an old video of this guy that works on a carrier ship or whatever, and he's outside at night and there's stuff like flying next to the boat, not flying, but in the water, swimming so fast next to the boat.
Yeah.
And they're like, jump in. Oh my gosh. Yep. Could you imagine, like, everything is just like coming out of the woodworks, and I don't know what's going on. And maybe it's always been this way, but I don't know.
I screenshot this to send to you later, but it's funny. It says, my boss told me I had no PTO left, and I said, okay, I'll just use Brenda's because if I'm going to do her job, I'm getting her benefits too.
We are always plotting at work. Like, we were talking the other day, like, how could we, like, if somebody needs PPTO, can we, like, give it to them and then give it back to us. Like, I was like, we would always have PPTO. But, yeah, we plot at work on that stuff. Okay. So, tonight's a fun one. I love tonight's episode. And you haven't seemed that excited about it. Are you listening to me?
Mm-hmm.
You haven't
I'm
been.
Watching this where this 15-year-old girl, she just lured her ex-boyfriend into a house to be brutally murdered by a group of teen boys.
What?
And she has no, like, feelings on it. Like, here she is being interrogated, and she, like, could care less. Like, it happened, and she just don't care.
Mm-mm-mm. That's, this world is just insane. And that's another thing we'll go over is how, like, in this story, the world, we didn't have social media back then because this story's from the 1930s and there was no social media. And this, like, rocked the U.S. when this happened. Like, everybody went into shock because we weren't used to stuff like this. Now, you get on your phone and you see stuff, and like, even like, we're doing the Valentine's Day massacre, and even when I was like doing this, only 7 people died in the massacre, and I was like, well, is that really a massacre, you know? Like, I
it's
mean
not enough,
that, like, why are they calling this a massacre? But
Friday night.
Yeah, like, what, that's not a lot. And it's so bad that we are not sensitive to things like that because when this happened, the whole, like I said, United States was like,
well, that's why,
what the fuck?
Wasn't there a serial killer like I it kind of hit me one time. You were talking about one of them too, and it was like a really big deal. He was super like famous from what he did, but then kind of find out he'd only killed like 4 or 5 people. Yeah, granted that made him a serial killer, but it wasn't like. Like, I think it with social media and the movies we watch now, like,
yeah.
if those are rookie numbers.
Yeah, like, yeah. What's your problem? Why not more? And that's terrible that we think that way. But yeah, this whole time I was like, that's not a massacre. I was like, because you think a massacre, you're thinking like 20-something people, yeah. You know. And, like, one person is terrible. You know, and the way that we think, and I'm just like, I don't get it. But, you know, happening in your town, and let's dive in, y'all.
Yeah, we're getting off. We haven't started yet, and we've been rambling.
No, that's great. But like I said, we have desensitized ourselves, and it should not be that way at all. And this is a terrible thing that's happened. And like I said, I love this story. We're doing, as I said, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And, you know, I love, this is all about the old school mobsters. I love the mobsters. Mm. You know, how it was back then, Prohibition, and we're going to Chicago. It's going to be the North Side versus the South Side. And it's just, I've always been into mobsters.
Also, really quick, too, I sent this to you a while back. But you remember one of your favorite movies now, Cocaine Bear?
Yes.
Well, I sent this to you. Scientists are now investigating after sharks ingesting cocaine from dumped packages in the ocean. Can you imagine damn sharks? That's another movie coming.
That's Jaws, right? I mean,
that's Meg.
I saw that and it made me laugh. I was like, just stay out of the water. It's like on The Office. Yeah. When he's like, what's the safest way to ski? And he's like, don't ski. You know? Don't go in the water. But,
okay. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway, sorry about that. We get on our tangents. So, as I said, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. We're going to start with the two major players in the story. Just so you know who's going against who. Now, the first player is Bugs Moran. George Bugs Moran. And, y'all, it was Bugsy. So fun. No, this one's Bugs. I've heard people say Bugsy, but there was also another Bugsy. And I think this one is Bugs.
Sorry, I got to say something else real quick, too.
What?
21 years ago, The Final Destination 2 was released. And to this day, my generation still won't drive behind logging trucks.
I won't.
I won't either.
You saw that I posted on social media. I got behind a logging truck and I was like, y'all, I'm going to die.
Yeah. I'm right there along with you. That shit, it just hit you and stayed with you for some reason.
Yes, it really did. So last night when I knew that we were going to be doing this one, I had Ashlyn pull up a mob name generator. And I ask you a few questions, and it gave us our mob names. And Troy got Troy. Yours is so cool.
Well, obviously.
You got Troy the Shiv, which is amazing. At first, when me and Ashlyn did it for you, it was like Troy Peanut. That one wasn't so cool. Ashlyn's, though, was awesome. She got Ashlyn the Widowmaker.
That's cool.
Mine was Jennifer the Killer. But it asks you questions like, which era would you be? Would it be the Rat Pack era, the pro, you know, the mobster or the Prohibition era, just stuff like that. Would you be a mob boss? Would you be a mob wife? It was really fun. So if you get the itching, look up the mob name generator, and there's several, and figure out what your mob name is.
Remember when I did that other game though, my top three celebrity lookalikes?
What?
I got Steve Harvey. Love Steve Steve Harvey.
Yes.
But he definitely does not look like me.
I think I got Kanye.
You're not a hobbit again.
How you not a hobbit again? Just because.
Just because. You're under the house. And
you smoke your pipe. You talk to old wizards.
All right. Anyway, sorry.
All right. Okay. So the first key player from the North Side is Bugs Moran. George Bugs Moran.
Are you sure it's not Bugsy?
It says it's Bugs. Now, there was, like I said, another gangster named Bugsy.
Okay.
And he was born in 1893, February 25th. He was a Chicago Prohibition-era gangster born to Polish and Irish immigrants in Minnesota. And Moran moved to the North Side of Chicago in his teenage years. Now, growing up, he ran with several gangs and was in prison three times before he turned 21. Now, I would be pissed if this was my nickname, because here's the reason why. He earned the nickname Bugs after assaulting a tailor who he felt was gouging him because of his ethnicity. So, like, he was getting his pants fitted and the tailor kept, like, poking him with a needle. Leaving the tailor with two broken arms and two broken legs, the name Bugs came from those who thought he was just nuts or buggy. Yeah, I don't really like that. Moran, you know, I'm not a big fan of him. I feel like, you know, I'll always be on Al Capone's side on this.
That's so strange about that.
I know. Let's see. Moran began trying to make a name for himself in the Chicago underground, running liquor and hosting craps games. And eventually, Moran joined Dion O'Banion's gang, bringing his small-time rackets along with him. Now, in 1924, O'Banion was killed by Johnny Torrio's men, and Moran became second in command behind Earl Weiss. On January 25th, 1925, Weiss and Moran tried to kill Johnny Torrio. This is such a movie. Yeah. But just before Moran could kill him, execution style, Moran's gun misfired, and lacking any further ammo, a furious Moran had to back down. That was lucky for Torrio, right? Mm-hmm. The now terrified Torrio decided to retire. Okay. He ended up handling the whole operation over to none other than Al Capone.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Yes. And we'll go over Al Capone's backstory.
Hey, speaking of which, have you ever heard of that movie, The Untouchables?
You're a dick. Y'all. I'm telling them what you've been doing all week. So apparently Troy has seen this movie a million times, and I heard The Untouchables was such a great, it's like a close movie to this whole incident, okay? And I had never seen it. It's an old movie. It's from 1987, but it's such a great movie.
Keep in mind too, we're in the middle of rewatching Shameless. Okay, so anyways, go ahead.
So I'm like, I have to watch The Untouchables, because I'm my favorite movies to watch are movies about gangsters and stuff like that. I love them, if you haven't noticed. So I'm like, let's watch The Untouchables. I've never heard anything about it. So we started watching it, and Troy's like, I've seen this so many times, I don't want to watch it. And I was like, please. I was like, this is like research. And I start watching it. And Troy's like, it just brings back bad memories. Because every time. You're such a dick. And he's like, every time me and my ex-girlfriend wanted to do it, we would turn this movie on. And I'm like, that's a really weird movie to turn on for, like, whatever.
I guess what happened, guys.
So, like, he sat there and, like, complained the whole time. And I was like, you know what?
But guess what? We ended up not watching it.
Right. And
fellas, just learn.
No.
If there's a movie you don't want to watch, just bring up your ex.
But that didn't bother me. I was like, in my head, I was like, that's like doing it to E.T. or some shit. I was like, why would you pick a 1987 gangster movie? Why would that be the movie that every time y'all did, let's watch The Untouchables from like 1987?
Well, you know I was kidding.
Right? I knew you were kidding, but that was so...
I just didn't want to watch the movie. I wanted to finish Shameless.
But... if you want to watch a movie about this, it's an older one, like I said, The Untouchables. It's really good because it's kind of like Goodfellas. Cause
I've actually never seen it.
You're a dick. Because Capone, like, he flies off the handle on everything.
Kevin Costner's really young in that.
Yeah, he really is. But Robert De Niro is like Al Capone. And anything, because he starts to get power hungry because he gets so powerful. He just wants more and more and more. And it just gets so great from what I saw. Anyway. So, let's see. Weiss and Moran's bootlegging operations remain the only serious challenge to Al Capone's empire in Chicago. And Moran and Capone became ongoing rivals because of this. The two led bloody turf wars against each other for many years. And Moran hated Capone and verbally attacked him in the press as well, saying Capone is a lowlife. Ooh, that's like slapping him in the face with some gloves. Moran also felt superior to Capone's gang because Capone's gang was involved in the prostitution racket, something that Moran, a devout Catholic, refused to dabble in. So he was a little bit better than Capone. Because, like, he stole and he killed and,
That's just...
Yeah,
that's like... a hooker, like, well, we can have sex, but you can't kiss me.
Right, I mean... I mean, what's
the difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'm better than you because I don't do prostitution. Like, fuck off, Moran. Anyway, Capone was, like, pretty much down for anything that was going to make him money. He was, I mean, I'm already doing this, this, and this. Let's just add some more to it. So, let's see. On September 20th, 1926, Moran and, he's a devout Catholic. And on September 20th, 1926, Moran and his men attempted to have Al Capone killed in Cicero, Illinois, where Al Capone based his operations. But the hit was unsuccessful and Capone escaped. Now, our next hitter. Let's see. Next, we're going to talk about Al Capone. If I can find my article.
Ruh-roh Raggy. You know, that name, I don't think it'll always, like, be a huge name, like, forever in the history books. Like, you don't... There's nothing bigger than Al Capone.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. Let's see here. Sorry, I've got several different articles that kind of bring everything together. Okay. Alfonso Gabriel Capone was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1899 to the Italian immigrants. His parents, Gabriel Capone and Teresa Rayola, found working class jobs and settled into their new lives. Capone, however, had trouble fitting in and was expelled from school at age 14 for hitting his teacher.
You're talking to me.
After he left school, Capone tried his hand at odd jobs, but nothing really stuck. Capone eventually turned to a friend, Johnny the Fox Torrio.
Ooh.
I don't know why
on that name.
I don't know. He was just getting started building an empire. Torrio would go on to be called the father of American gangsterdom. The first, chief... Oh, shit. Okay. By Elmer Eyre, the first chief of the International Revenue Service Enforcement Branch, now referred to as the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. Now, Torrio introduced Capone to Frankie Yale and his first real taste of the underworld. Yale owned a number of clubs where patrons could go to drink, gamble, and pay for sex. Let's see. It was a speakeasy. He gave Capone a job as a bouncer and a bartender. And while at work, Capone, who wasn't known for being even-tempered, got into a fight. During the fight, he was slashed across his left cheek 3 times with a knife, leaving a permanent scar.
Capone was?
Yeah. And earning the nickname Scarface. Ooh. Supposedly, the fight was over a girl. Now, apparently...
Oh, my little friend.
Now, apparently, this was like old days Capone. Like, he was still young, you know. But apparently, he saw this girl and told her that, you know, she had a nice ass or something like that. And her boyfriend was there, and he was in the mob. And, you know, he was like, you need to take that back. You don't say things like that. And they got into it. And he was associated with another gang. And, you know, the guys that Capone was with was like, you kind of deserved it. Just leave it how it is. So you just shouldn't go off doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
Huh?
Yeah, I don't see Capone leaving it, though.
Well, he was, you know, he was still young. So he was like, that's fine. He wasn't in power yet. He was just a little bartender. So at age 18, Capone met and married Mae Coughlin. Now, I saw a picture of Mae, and she was gorgeous. Oh, my goodness. Because when you look up Al Capone, it has, like, other people you can look up to. I saw a picture.
That's the only wife he had.
Yeah, that was his wife, like, through and through, forever. Mae. Mae Capone. Soon, the couple had their first child, Albert Francis Sonny Capone. Sonny's birth gave Capone pause, briefly to consider making an honest living. The family even moved to Baltimore, where Capone intended to become a bookkeeper.
What?
Working the numbers on the right side of the law, which is funny how he got caught with him being a bookkeeper. But Capone couldn't resist the allure of the gangster life. And when Torrio...
Oh, once you get the money and the power and...
Yeah. He couldn't resist. And Torrio asked Capone to move to Chicago to help run his mob empire. It was an offer that Capone couldn't refuse. And you know what? Back then, if a mob boss came to me and was like, you want to help me run this empire? I'd be like, fuck yeah, I do. Let's go. You know?
It's easy to get away with shit back then, too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. The dark side quickly caught up to Torrio. And in 1925, he barely survived the assassination attempt that we talked about. Where was I? He barely survived the assassination attempt that I talked about with Weiss and Bugs Moran, where I told y'all that Bugs Moran, his gun backfired or didn't go off, and he had to let him go. Okay. So after spending 3 weeks in the hospital and even more time in prison, Torrio was done. He was scared shitless. He decided to leave Chicago and handed over the control of his empire to none other than Capone. So, Capone was a natural at making money and quickly expanded the business. By the mid-1920s, oh my God, this got me, y'all. Capone was taking home $60 million a year. Now,
that would be what? How much now?
$891 million in today's time.
Every year?
Every year. And his wealth continued to grow. He started topping out in the 1920s at $100 million a year, which would be $1.5 billion in today's time a year.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Like... 1 year of work, you'd be set for life. You know, if he could have just walked away, he would have been fine. Now, As Capone's empire grew, so did his penchant for violence. The bodies piled up in Chicago, and most had Capone's fingerprints all over them. Now, I am going to stop. Capone was violent, but while he was making this money, he was doing good with it. He was giving back to the city, and he was giving to the poor. And the town loved him. People that weren't in the mob, you know, they loved Capone. They thought he was wonderful at this point in his life. You know, what city wouldn't if, you know, somebody's making loads of money and they're just giving it back to the community, right?
Right.
So they loved him at this point.
Kind of like a Robin Hood.
Kind of. The feds, however, they didn't like it. They couldn't make...
For sure.
Yeah. They couldn't make charges. And they couldn't figure it out. So they knew he was violent and they knew he was dangerous, but something happened in 1927, miles away from Chicago, that would prove to be a turning point. And on May 16th, 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in U.S. versus Sullivan that from the illicit traffic in liquor, they're subject to income tax, would be taxable. It was just the ruling that the feds would need. So, let's see. In 1928, they were finally fed up. The Secretary of the Treasury summoned Irie and told him to simply get Capone. So, basically, any way they could, they had to get Capone.
Find a way.
Yeah. Irie is said to have replied on behalf of the... you know, Irie replied, we'll get right on it. And they did. So... let's get into it.
Let's dive on in.
Now that we know the key players, we've got Moran and Capone. So, there it is. Is this confusing?
No, it's not.
Okay, because I feel like it's confusing. Now, here's a picture of the massacre. That was on the front of newspapers. And you can look it up, you guys, and I'll post some pictures on Instagram. Let's see. On February 14th, 1929, Frank Guzenberg was rushed to a Chicago hospital with 14 gunshot wounds. But when the police asked who shot him, he had a surprising answer. No one shot me. Huh. I'd be like, are you serious? You're going to die. You can tell us. You've obviously been shot. But come to find out, even though they had turf wars and it was like, you know, mobsters versus mobsters or whatever, the number one enemy was the police. They would not snitch on each other, you know?
Right.
I guess that's just how it was. Like, even in the movie Goodfellas, like, the guy, and I don't know if y'all have seen, watch Goodfellas. You must. It's such a good movie. So, you know, the guy ends up going to jail and because he won't snitch somebody out, but watch Goodfellas. It's such a good movie. Now, Guzenberg, a well-known local gangster, was either determined to adhere to the criminal's code of silence or terrified of whoever he knew to be behind the attack. 3 hours later, he was dead, which I'm surprised he lasted that long. 14 gunshots.
Damn.
Okay. So, upon its death... Guzenberg became the final victim of what came to be known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, perhaps the most infamous mob hit in history. Guzenberg and six other members of George Bugs Moran's Northside Gang had been lined up against a wall in his garage and slaughtered in a hail of gunfire. Do you know what they used?
What?
Tommy guns and shotguns. I love Tommy guns. Many believe that the feared Al Capone was behind the hit, which might explain Guzenberg's reluctance to say a word to the cops. But to this day, the perpetrators of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre remain unknown for certain.
No one was ever prosecuted, right?
Nobody was.
It's
now,
still a cold case now, till now, isn't it?
Maybe. I didn't read anything about that, but I mean, and Yeah, because they never found anybody.
Yeah, it's still the coldest case since February 14th, 29.
Seriously?
Suspicions of Al Capone, but still a cold case.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he never, like, said that it was him. But everybody knew. Yeah. Around 10:30 a.m. on February 14th, 1929, four men approached Moran's warehouse at 2122 North Clark Street. Two were dressed. This plan is freaking genius. Two were dressed as police officers. The other two looked like well-dressed civilians in suits and ties, while the driver wore an expensive chinchilla and gray fedora. Ugh, fedoras, are you serious? Mm. I still think people should dress like that.
So why was Capone's nickname also Snorky?
I don't know. I didn't see anything about that.
Yeah, it says Alphonse or whatever, Gabriel Capone, blah, blah, blah. Nicknames known as Scarface and Snorky.
Look that up, because now I want to know. Okay, so where was the fedora? They were there on business, but not the kind of business that usually unfolded in bright daylight. The six men inside the warehouse were affiliated with the gang leader, George Bugs Moran. Let's see. One of them, Reinhardt Schwimmer, wasn't really a gang member. He was actually an optometrist, but he liked hanging out with the underworld friends. Like, he thought he was really cool hanging out with the gangsters, a little optometrist guy. And that was just wrong day for him. But the others were a mix of killers, embezzlers, and robbers, as well as a German shepherd named Highball. And we'll talk about Highball anyway.
Oh, never mind. It was, Snorky was, he was called that by his friends and associates.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was slang, meaning sharp dresser, like classy wardrobe and stuff.
We need to learn the slang from back then.
That would be cool. Bring it back.
Bring, yes.
Slang nowadays sucks. Bruh.
I hate that.
Oh, God, bruh.
If Ashlyn calls me bruh one more time. but yeah, we're going to talk about Highball because Highball was wonderful. Now, all of them answered to Moran and none of them expected anything. What was I saying? None of them expected anything out of the ordinary on that cold February morning. So, outside, the four unidentified men had been waiting on a signal. And when Albert Weinschenk, a nightclub owner, who they may have mistaken for Moran himself, entered the building, the four men got the signal to move in. With that, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre was underway. Now, could you imagine being mistaken as Moran? I would move away. There's a whole nother gang going after Moran, and you look like him. You were mistaken for him. You know? Like, that would be the absolute worst. No one knows exactly what happened in the warehouse. Were Moran's men alarmed? Did they shrug it off as a police raid? And in any case, they did what they were told. The seven men lined up against the wall, their backs to the intruders. Then the strangers raised their guns. Thompson, submachine guns, better known as Tommy guns, and a 12-gauge shotgun opened fire. Now, here's the thing about Tommy guns. Do you know how many bullets they hold?
No.
They hold like a shit ton.
Yeah, it's probably close to like a 20 to 30, something like that.
But like, there were, oh my gosh, that they go off like crazy. Like, it does not take long to let it out. So anyway, bullets sprayed across the line of Marin's men, splattering blood, breaking bone, and even punching into the brick wall behind them.
Oh no. The circular magazine actually held 50 to 100 rounds.
So, four men with Tommy guns.
It was a big drum, yeah.
Yeah.
The box magazines have a capacity of 20 or 30, while the drum magazines has a capacity of 50 rounds.
That's insane. So, as I said, a bullet sprayed across the line of Moran's men, splattering blood, breaking bone, and punching into the wall behind them.
600 rounds a minute.
Yeah. So could you imagine? Meanwhile, the whole time, Highball howled, but was spared from the bullets and was later found by the police alive, tied to a car bumper nearby. Now listen, these guys may have been into killing and all that stuff, but they didn't touch the dog. And that's an A+ in my book.
Y'all are good to go.
Yeah, we're good to go. If the dog doesn't die, I'm good. So the attack ended as quickly as it started. The killers left the building and disappeared into the wind. Now here's the thing. They had a cop car too. So what they did was they jumped back in the police car and turned the lights on and took off. So nobody thought anything about it. They were like, oh, it's the police, you know, no biggie. Here's the pictures of the men.
Those are real ones?
Yeah, those are the real crime scene pictures. Back in the warehouse, six of Moran's men lay dead. Albert Kachelik, Adam Hayer Weinshank, Schwimmer, John May, and Peter Gusenberg. Peter's brother, Frank Gusenberg, died later that day. The likely target, however, escaped the incident entirely. Moran never made it to the warehouse that morning. Now, here's the thing. Moran was walking to the warehouse. He was running late, but he saw the police car and turned around and went back. Like, he should have been there. But there was also that guy there that looked like Moran. So, as I said, he saw the police car, turned around. He wasn't going. He changed his mind. He did not want to deal with that. Because, as you know, y'all, the mob had the police in their pocket. Capone even made sure that the mayor that they had, he got that mayor elected so he could have him in his pocket and do everything he wanted to. He owned the police. When they had elections, he had his guys stand at the election booth with guns, making sure that everybody voted for the right man. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
But with everyone dead and no witnesses left, other concrete details about the shooting remain few and far between. To this day, we mostly just have the grisly photos of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre to give us some clues as to what exactly happened inside the warehouse. Now, the ensuing investigation into the massacre focused primarily on rival Chicago mobster Al Capone. Even though the gangster had been in a Florida courthouse, where was I? At the time, but Capone had a wide reach. He also had a well-known vendetta against Moran, and moreover, the hit reeked of Capone's style. Now, he was in Florida, Capone was, but he let the newspapers know that he was in Florida. Does that make sense? Like, before he went, he was like, I'm so excited to go to Florida. I'm going to have so much fun in Florida on February 14th, 1920 or 1930, you know? So, like, everybody knew Capone was not going to be there. So that was pretty much his alibi, if that makes sense. For much of the decade preceding the massacre, Bugs and Capone ran bitterly opposing gangs in Chicago. Moran's men were Irish Northsiders and Capone's were Italian Southsiders. Southside, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
The two men clashed often and violently over control of the city in the 20s, especially when it came to bootlegging booze during the Prohibition. In September of 1926, Bugs and his men escalated in the conflict when they drove past a hotel where Capone and his men were eating and sprayed the building with more than 1,000 bullets. But somehow, Capone escaped unharmed. I can just see it, though, in a nice little, like, little bitty restaurant, the gang sitting there, like, eating their food, talking business, and then, like, it's a drive-by. Somebody drives by, shoots it up with 1,000 bullets. More than likely Tommy gun, so it probably took about 2 seconds to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they drove off. But Capone was fine. Also, if you haven't seen him, that's Al Capone.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him, yeah.
Eventually, upon hearing that Bugs had put a $50,000 bounty on his head, Capone allegedly decided he'd had enough of the turf wars, and he was going to strike first, and his strike was going to be fatal. Now, I was listening to several podcasts about this, and the way they would get people was, you know, they'd threaten them or they'd, you know, be like, if you back down, we'll do this. We'll get you a car. We'll give you money. We'll give you girls. And if somebody like, what you call it, if it doesn't work, then they're going to start taking people out around you. Like, it's just Elliot Ness. Why do I keep calling him Van Ness? But they, like, one of the guys that was on the case that helped take him down, they offered everything, and he was like, no, you know, that's why he was called an untouchable, because he could not be bribed or anything. He was going to get the job done and all that. But that's how they did it. They would start taking people out around you. They'd go after your family until it left you with nothing, nothing you could lean on or anything. And that's going to weaken somebody, right? Mm-hmm. So that's exactly how they did their stuff. So now, in the weeks leading up to the St. Valentine's Day massacre, Moran had been working on procuring a shipment of stolen Canadian whiskey. Ooh, could you imagine how much one of those bottles would be worth that Moran owned? That would be so cool. An enterprise in which Capone was also heavily invested. Moran ran his illegal operation out of the SMC Cartage Company garage on Clark Street, which will become the site of the shooting. And on the morning of February 14th, Capone's men would have known to find Moran's men there and had a motive to kill them. But it's likely that Moran was the ultimate target. In fact, Moran had been at the scene, but he'd simply arrived late upon seeing the police car outside, like I said. He turned and walked the other way. He went and got a coffee, and running into one of his associates, he told him to avoid the garage because it looked like the police were doing a raid. Which, that was fine with them, because since they own the police around there, where was I?
It didn't really matter.
Yeah, like, if they were raiding it, all he had to do, they'd be out by the end of the day. Like, it didn't matter, yeah. You know? But Moran had no idea that someone had just murdered seven of his men. So, while Moran escaped, whoever killed his men had accomplished one goal. Moran's grip on power weakened after the massacre. His days as one of Chicago's top gangsters had ended. But the question of who was behind the massacre remained. Now, after they weakened Moran like the way they did, he ended up dying at the age of 65, and he was worth $100. He started doing petty crimes. Like, he would get put in jail, he'd go like rob a gas station or something and get put in jail again. Like, this mob boss that, you know, was up there with Capone, he, you know, he lost it all. And that, I started to feel bad for him when I heard that. I was like, that's kind of sad. Wow. But it's not sad. Good for him, because he deserved that. But he did die in prison and had nothing. Most of the evidence does point to Fred Burke, an associate of Capone's. He got in a car crash and killed a police officer on December 14th, 1929. He escaped, but police discovered the guns in his home that were used in the massacre. Burke was finally arrested in 1931 and refused to name any names. Another man, allegedly a low-level gangster associated with Capone, later claimed that Capone had planned the hit in October or November of 1928. Yeah. He had been planning it this whole entire time. Byron Bolton said that he had acted as a lookout on the morning of the massacre. His job was to give a signal once Moran arrived. Bolton thought he saw Moran, so he gave the signal, and it's likely that he mistook Albert Weinschenk for the gang leader. For his part, Moran had no doubts about who was responsible. "Only Capone kills like that," was a quote that he said. But was Capone really responsible for the massacre? Not everyone thinks so. After all, Moran and his men had more than one enemy. And first of all, the shooters had worn police uniforms. That could be the explanation, simply be that it was attacked by the Chicago police. I don't think so. When Sergeant Thomas J. Loftus arrived at the scene, he found Gusenberg alive among the carnage. "Cops did it," Gusenberg said. Of course, Gusenberg had good reason to think that. He had assumed that the men in front of the garage were policemen, just as Moran had. Investigators initially dismissed this possibility, but later wondered if it could be sound. And apparently, Moran and his men had stolen bootleg liquor from a crooked cop. Could the St. Valentine's Day massacre be retaliation? But if so, why had the attackers left money, thousands of dollars, in the pockets of their victims? One theory eyed the Purple Gang, a Detroit-based gang with whom Capone had ties, and another suggested a political motive, as Capone and Moran had supported different candidates in a recent election. Some suspected that Moran himself had ordered the hit, perhaps because he'd grown irritated with the Guisenberg brothers. Others thought that the Guisenberg brothers may have been the targets because they'd killed a young firefighter and his family wanted revenge. I can name 50 motives for this crime, the lead investigator of the state attorney's office said, and yet investigators kept circling back to Al Capone. It wasn't only that Capone had motive and means. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre was violent and shocking in a way that had become Capone's trademark. And this put significant pressure on officials to crack down on gang activity in Chicago in many ways. The massacre marked the beginning at the end of the certain Wild West period in the underworld of Chicago, even the country as a whole. From coast to coast, people suddenly seemed to be reaching the conclusion that a line had been crossed, that the violence had become too much to bear. Now, there was a part in The Untouchables where Capone's having a huge dinner with his guys, and he finds out one of them isn't as trustworthy as he thought, and he makes this huge speech, and he's walking around the table, and he's holding a baseball bat, and he's like, what's the one thing we all need? And they're like, trust. And he's like, yes, and you need teamwork and all this stuff. And he comes up to this guy, and this guy's like nodding his head, and he beats him to death with the baseball bat. That's just how Capone was. He was ruthless. He was wild. You never knew what he was going to do. But still.
I want to tell you something real quick, too.
What?
So, the place where the massacre happened,
mm-hmm.
they destroyed the building, and it's now vacant lot or whatever because of all the people visiting or whatever. But there was this Canadian guy who purchased the back wall of that building.
The bricks.
All the bricks, yeah. And he sold some of them, took them on tour. But he finally sold, or it was finally sold to a mob museum in Vegas that has most of the bricks now. So my question is, I wonder if they're haunted.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we aren't just doing a true crime story. There's hauntings to go with it. And the bricks, a lot of people, after, you know, the wall went down, a lot of people took the bricks. They ended up having bad luck, and they all gave the bricks back because they thought they were cursed.
Oh.
Yeah. So they even put it in a bar, and it was the backdrop for the men's room. Like, even the women could come in and see it if they wanted to because it was the actual bricks. And they put targets where the men were supposed to hit. And they ended up getting rid of it because it just started causing bad luck. But still, Capone was never charged in connection with the massacre. Nevertheless, if investigators couldn't get public enemy number one for that, then they were determined to get him for something else.
Wonder what that was.
And this sucks. Like, you know, yeah. It was a smart move on their part, but it really sucks. In the end, it was actually a mundane white-collar crime that brought down the almighty Al Capone. Now, before I start on this, what actually got Capone was him and one of his friends were at the movies, and he was caught with a concealed weapon. That's how they got him in jail. While he sat in jail, this is what else they found. They convicted him on income tax evasion and soon sentenced him to 11 years in prison. Now, he was eventually released early in 1939, but by that point, he was already slipping into a long period of poor health, largely due to syphilis. He died of cardiac arrest in 1947 at the age of 48. To the end, authorities never got anything out of him or his men about the blood-soaked shooting that occurred in that Chicago warehouse all those years ago. And to this day, the massacre remains unsolved. So, they never got their answer. And what an awful way to go from syphilis.
Yeah, I know.
So, they said that by the time he died, he had the mind capacity of a 12-year-old. Like,
that's sad.
It's so sad.
I wonder if people or doctors didn't want to, like, heal him.
I don't think they knew about it as much back then as what we know today, you know? Now, we talked about Highball. After Highball, the police came and the dog, because I would want to know what happened to the dog. The dog was not shot. The dog was not injured, but he did have mental issues after that, and the police had to put him down because he was not a stable puppy after that, which who can blame him, you know? Right. My dogs hear fireworks, and they're traumatized for 2 days, so imagine what Highball went through. And I've got a picture of Highball, y'all, and I will post it. Now, on to the hauntings. Capone was never sent to jail, as I said, for murder, but for carrying a concealed weapon. His cell at the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia was extremely well-furnished and even decorated. And before I go any further, I'm going to show you his jail cell. I had to take a picture. Huh. Like, are you serious right now? Uh-huh. Nobody else got that. I'll post it, y'all. Let's see. However, Al was convinced there were two people occupying the one-bed cell. This marked the beginning of Al Capone's haunting. Capone was miserable and would shout out at night for Jimmy to leave him alone. The other prisoners heard him screaming out at night and even having conversations with someone. When Capone was released, he hoped Jimmy would stay behind, but wherever Al went, Jimmy went too. It was like the world's least fun odd couple. Eventually, Al ordered a psychic to try to get rid of Jimmy, to leave him alone. The plan, you may not be surprised to hear, did not work. Al's fear of Jimmy eventually became so great that his bodyguards would often rush into the room at night thinking he was under attack, only to find Scarface alone and terrified. It was the beginning of the end for his sanity. Now here's where it gets interesting. Capone was convicted again, and this time for tax evasion. He gets sent to prison in Atlanta and then transferred to Alcatraz. Did you know that? I didn't know he went to Alcatraz. By this time, he's suffering from syphilis. He'd known he had syphilis for quite some time, but he was too embarrassed to seek treatment. Plus, May probably would have killed him. Without getting too graphic, here's a quick syphilis rundown. It starts with a sore on your genitals. The second stage is a body rash, and then the syphilis disappears. In reality, it's boring its way into your major organs, often the heart, liver, and brain. And for over a decade, the syphilis made its way into Al Capone's brain and made him certifiably nuts. Beyond just screaming at his ghost enemy, Jimmy, his behavior became so bizarre, they released him on good behavior. Turns out you can escape Alcatraz. You just have to let an STD destroy your brain. Now, everybody believed that Jimmy was with Al Capone till the very end. He would sit there and have conversations with him. You know, it was terrifying for him. Also, in case you didn't know, while in Alcatraz, Capone didn't have ties in California. That was just a good ways away from Chicago. So he had to be on his best behavior, actually. The guards were not taking his nonsense. They could not be bought off. They were just like, Capone who? So he begged the guard to start a band. And the guard was like, you know what? Fine. You can start a band, but you only get 20 minutes a day to practice. And it is rumored that at Alcatraz, you can hear Capone and his band playing at night. Isn't that crazy? That gave me chills. Now, here's where the grass and stuff was, where the building and everything, where they got shot. Now, this nondescript patch of grass, pretty much a parking lot, is a point
is
of...
Is it by that tree, though? The actual spot?
Yeah, because it's an old folks' home now. Yeah. So, the point of pilgrimage for the countless true crime pilgrims each year. The site of the bloodbath, February 14th, 1929, is still said to bear ghostly marks of the cold-blooded killings. Though the garage in which they happened are gone, the ghostly rattle of machine gun fire, a phantom dog's urgent bark, and dark gangster-like figures in fedoras have all been reported in that area.
Oh.
Residents of the building that flank the site say that after a fresh snow, you can sometimes see the outline of 7 bodies in the snow where the bodies fell on that blustery morning long ago. Dang. Could you imagine? Can we please go? Oh my gosh.
No. We can go to Alcatraz.
We can go to Chicago. Southside, right? Southside. We've been watching too much Shameless, y'all. There's Highball.
Aww.
Your precious Peppy. I love Highball. And that is it. And there's also in one of the jails, I forget which one, I think it's the Eastern State Penitentiary, you can hear him singing from his jail cell too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can take tours and stuff like that. That is the Valentine's Day Massacre. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. I got so excited. I think I kind of stumbled on my words a little bit because the story, I love the story so much. And maybe I can finish watching The Untouchables one day.
And guys, I hope everybody has a great Valentine's Day coming up, a.k.a. Penis Christmas.
Penis Christmas, yes.
So I hope everybody has a good penis Christmas. And take your vitamins and drink water.
Yes, and make good choices. Thank you for listening. We will see you guys next Sunday.
Cartman Bra.
Bye, y'all.